Welcome back to 21st Century Radio. I'm Dr. Bob Hieronymus, and our final guest is Gary Gianetti. Now, the overflow of emails we receive daily make it impossible for me to respond to 99% of what's offered to us. However, a fraction of the 1% that we consider responding to are rarely as important to our programming as the one or series of ones we've received from, well, an out-of-state listener, Gary Gianetti, who has successfully salvaged some of America's history from their watery graves. Now, those of you who have seen the history specials on which we've been interviewed, say on Discovery, National Geographic, History Channels, as well as Canadian, Russian, German television, etc., 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 know that our expertise is in the study of history and the meaning of American symbols, such as the American flag, the Great Seal of the United States, Statue of Liberty, the Liberty Bell, etc. And most Americans, such as Sarah Palin, do not know who designed our American flag, let alone its seal, coat of arms, or a few also realize that there has been considerable disagreement as to how the five-pointed star became to symbolize America. Now, our guest for the remaining hour on 21st Century Radio is Gary Gianetti, who has some ideas about the star's origins that we will be discussing. He may have made an important discovery or rediscovery that professional historians should be reconsidering. However, before we get into that, he sent me an email just yesterday that I was so fascinated with, it dealt with actually the Great Seal of the United States. Could you summarize what that missive to me yesterday was about, Gary?
Yes, I can, Bob. Recently, with some of my work, I was working on colonial cannons, but colonial cannons from the American Revolution that are American manufactured. In this process of finding some of these very few cannons that exist, I had done research in New Jersey. And there at Washington Crossings, there's a gentleman named Mr. Swan, famous family colonial descendant from the American Revolution, who is one of the great collectors today of American Revolutionary War relics. I believe it was his father, or possibly him, but by the 1940s, a relic surfaced when he had his feelers out there, people that look for relics for him. And they actually found a Great Seal, which is believed to be the Great Seal that John Jay had personally brought over to Spain, where Benjamin Franklin was. And it hasn't been proven true yet, if it's authentic. And in this case, there is possibly a way to prove it authentic. And my goal is to possibly go out and find the original impressions made by this stamp and match it up to see if it's the real deal.
You know who we should consider, or who you should consider bringing in on this? The keeper of the seal.
That would be a wonderful...
let's see, I'm trying to... Her name is coming to me because she spent several hours with us a couple of years ago at the State Department. And she's extraordinarily sensitive and very intelligent. And, of course, is open to, because she's an historian, open to other things that most people in the State Department wouldn't necessarily look at. Maybe if we have first alert her to this and see if it's possible for this group in New Jersey to make an imprint on it, then maybe that's a way of starting this whole thing.
I think I agree with you on that. My guess would be that to contact someone there if they care. I think that they would be amazed, and I think this would be an opportunity to be able to save the possible missing seal that was in Europe. I mean, this was used for all kinds of documents, and how did it disappear? No one knows about it.
Yeah. Well, that's really fascinating. Could you describe it a little about its size and those of you who have, by the way, those of you who have copies of my book, Founding Fathers: Secret Societies, or United Symbolism of America, but mostly Founding Fathers Secret Societies. Take a look at the 1782 die. Is that, that's the die we're talking about, right?
It would be the 1782 die, the one that was brought with John Jay.
Yeah.
And the website, it's called the Swan Foundation Collection. You could see it on the site, but they don't allow an excellent picture for you to see it up close. It's a brass bronze type of seal, and it looks like it could be.
Yeah.
Authentic.
What do you think it maybe is, about an inch and a half to 2 inch in diameter or something?
Like that? One and a quarter.
One and a quarter. One and a quarter.
I believe that's what they listed it, yeah.
Yeah. Well, I think this is fascinating because anything like this that our founding fathers treasured, and especially when we talk about a Benjamin Franklin who understood its symbols. Now, he wasn't sitting on the committee that actually designed us, as you well know, but he was on one of the first committees, and this is where a lot of pseudo-historians make serious mistakes about the Great Seal's history by thinking that Franklin, Adams, and Jefferson designed it. And as you know, and certainly the State Department knows, that most of their ideas were rejected.
Yeah.
And that's important to remember, because we really need to get our history accurate. But they purchased this, I understand from what you said, for $7.
I believe that when I spoke to Mr. Swan, who is the owner of this relic, mm-hmm. Who has it in the State Museum in New Jersey, next to Washington Crossings right there on the river,
mm-hmm.
that he told me that I think he acquired it, or his father did, one or the other, for about $7.
Wow.
And I know there's a lot of knockoffs, but this man is a magnificent collector of some great relics, and the odds that this is real and true, there's a great potential and possibility that it is.
Do you think he might have any objections to the State Department looking at it?
I don't think he would. I think if it is real and it could be proven, I mean, this guy would be a hero in my heart.
Yeah.
And I would love to see people go down and support that museum and that state park as well. And
yeah,
that would be the win-win for everybody, because I mean, for him to have acquired it and have it put in a museum on display. But the thing is, a lot of people don't even acknowledge this even exists there.
Yeah. Well, Priscilla at the State Department, and gosh, Rudy, I keep remembering her just as Priscilla. But you will enjoy meeting and talking with her. She is so knowledgeable. She is the lady that designed the Great Seal exhibit that they put together back in 2005. 6, 7, and 8. She really has changed the whole problem that the State Department used to have in regarding to the history of the seal. Whereas back when I was involved in this in 66, 67, and 68, the State Department that I kept writing to didn't necessarily want to hear from me or talk about the pyramid and the eye and the triangle, which was I was trying to understand. Now, there are other things that you have sent us and that I found fascinating, and especially this one particular paragraph that I'm going to read deals with, in our trying to understand and get to the bottom of where the five-pointed star came from in the United States. There are a lot of theories on this, but we really don't know as of yet. But this is what you sent to me that I think was important, dealing with under the Stuarts in the court of Star Chamber. You said that King James I and his son Charles used the court as of Star Chamber to examine cases of sedition, which meant that the court could be used to suppress opposition to royal policies. It came to be used to try nobles too powerful to be brought to trial in the lower court. King Charles I used the court of Star Chamber as parliamentary substitute during the 11 years of personal rule, when he ruled without a parliament. King Charles made extensive use of the court of Star Chamber to prosecute dissenters, including the Puritans who fled to New England. What else can you tell us about the Star Chamber that may be missing from our history books?
Well, what I do know is that the Star Chamber was originally created to help people of lesser power that weren't monarchs. And in this case, it was used to aid these people that could not defend themselves from other monarchs that had power that were They couldn't be touched, untouchables. And so in this case, it was reversed. But the star chamber in the story and the facts that are written is that in this chamber, that when you walked in there, there's a door, the door and then the ceiling above in this chamber had stars placed above it to let you know where you were when you were standing before these judges, your placement in the universe. Mm-hmm. And my guess is that I honestly believe that it has great potential at being that this is where the origin of how these stars are associated to our flag, the persecution of Puritans.
Well, this is really important because, you know, most people when they think about the Puritans, think of them dressed in black with silver buckles and all of that, which wasn't true. They'd like to dress in a lot of colors. They were very colorful characters. I shouldn't have said characters, but they were they loved color, and it's very unfortunate that we always put them in black. Now let's get to this illustration of the star. No historians have pinpointed the specific origins of what the meaning or usage of the five-pointed star on the American flag represents. And as you know, we're not talking about the 13 states of the and its religious symbols. Why have no historians ever found any such documentation proving or getting involved in this? Because I'm certain that most Americans are sitting there today saying, I thought we knew where all this came from.
A lot do, but I see it as that it's just been lost. It's like tying your shoe. I mean, there probably were once documents, but these documents were lost in time.
Mm-hmm.
And today, what I see is that there was history left here from the important families, the governor of Connecticut, these families that were being prosecuted by the king, his son. And basically, there was a Robert Treat Payne, who was one of the members of Continental Congress and one of the members that was a Mason. His grandfather was Robert Treat, who is from Milford, here where I live, the Milford Colony. And his actual seal, Governor's seal, had a heart with two arrows shot through it with a five-pointed star. And I spent years trying to understand what this meant. And basically, he was the person that defied the King of England and refused to give up the Connecticut Charter.
Mm-hmm.
And basically, this is what I think it symbolizes, is that it represents the Star Chamber using their powers with the king to be able to take away the charters, which they did. They didn't get the Connecticut Charter, but they took away all Massachusetts Charter and everything else and everyone else's rights all the way up the coast to Maine and New Hampshire.
What was the purpose in their doing that? Why did they do that?
Well, basically, it was a turn of power. The King of England's father was killed by the regicides, and the regicides were being hidden here in Connecticut and Massachusetts. And Robert Treat was one of the friends to the regicides. And these regicides were the judges and the men that persecuted the King of England during the war, Civil War with Cromwell. And again, they wound up killing the king. They beheaded him, and that was done by Reverend Hugh Peters. They believe he was the swinger of the axe.
In a certain sense, it is balancing out the murder of a king.
Yep, the father.
His father.
They
right.
were going for revenge against the families yeah. in New England and in England.
Let's go back to Robert Treat Payne, because this is fascinating stuff. Robert Treat Payne and his great-grandfather, Governor Robert Treat, who found every reason, as you note, to delay and not give up the Connecticut Royal Charter to the King's Governor. He succeeded, did he not?
He succeeded. He did. And the charter was taken from underneath their noses at night from the British that went to go and collect it, and it was placed inside of the what's known as the Charter Oak Tree.
Mm-hmm.
And but still today, no one's ever seen the original document itself.
Well, let's go back to that seal chosen by Governor Treat. And what did those two arrows shot through the heart mean?
I interpret this as it being in representation to the crown hurting them, just destroying them, literally. It's being shot through their hearts, like having a broken heart, but being shot through their heart.
Yeah.
It's my interpretation. It's the atrocities from the crown, from the Star Chamber itself.
So, but the Payne family is linked to the holy war against the Muslims and the Knights Templars, is it not?
Well, no one knows if Robert Shreve Payne is the direct link, but we're certain there are historians and scholars that believe he is. Mm-hmm. It's Moses Payne, who was in the circle there with the Quincy's and the Eatons, and Robert Shreve Payne is also an Eaton, and he's a Willard. Mm-hmm. And that's Major Simon Willard, because Simon Willard, his one great-grandfather, and Robert Shreve, the other great-grandfather, these were the heads and the commanders of the military prior to when Governor Shreve became governor.
You know,
and
excuse me, I'm sorry.
And they're the direct links to the adventurers, the adventurers to the companies in England, the Plymouth Company, the Massachusetts Bay Company, the Virginia Company, the West Indies Company, the British East India Companies.
But
they're all connected.
We need to take our final break on 21st Century Radio. And when we come back, we'll talk a little bit more of that, especially Willard, because our very first guest, we were honored by the former president of the National Press Club joining us, who is a fellow admirer of Charles Thompson, and I'm certain you know who Charles Thompson is. Most Americans don't, unfortunately. One of the United States' forgotten founders who helped design the obverse of the Great Seal of the United States. And we talked a little bit about Willard Hotel, which is kind of interesting in regards to bringing up his name again, which we didn't plan on that, but I mean, that's just the way it worked out. We'll be back with our guest, Gary Giannotti, an American history relic hunter who has made some startling discoveries about the United States Great Seal and the five-pointed star, which we'll continue to discuss when we return. Hey friends, be sure to sign up as a fan of the 21st Century Radio page on Facebook. Stay up to date with our guests and other news, and you can even listen to recent shows in the comfort of Facebook while you're browsing your Facebook news feeds. Please like our page at facebook.com/21st Century Radio and stay up to date on what we're doing. Welcome back to 21st Century Radio. Stevie Ray Vaughan. Is that Stevie Ray Vaughan? No, it's not. No. Well, I just got fired. It's Eric Clapton. Well, Stevie Ray Vaughan used to like Eric Clapton anyway. We'll be back with Eric Clapton and Stevie Ray Vaughan another time, friends. But our guest right now is Gary Giannotti, an American history relic hunter who has made some startling discoveries about the United States Great Seal in New Jersey and the five-pointed star, which we're going to focus on a little bit more here because I'm certain most people in our listening audience are not, they have not necessarily known about the possibility that we really don't know exactly where that star came from. Historians have documented the fact that the members of the Continental Congress elected a Marine committee, and it was these members of the committee who chose the design using stars and stripes for the need of the newly formed United States Continental Navy ship identification. Who were the members of the Marine committee, and why? What expertise did they have to design our flag for the Continental Navy ships?
Oh, Bob, on that one there. The committee was made up of people appointed by Continental Congress. Hancock was kind of on the committee there, but also John Adams, Gadsden. You're familiar with the Gadsden flag, the yellow Marine flag with the snake on it?
Yes, of course.
Yeah, he was a part of it, and there were a couple other members. Mm-hmm. But the thing was is that no one truly knows where it originated, except that with the stripes, they know the stripes came from an association to the East Indies companies, the seven provinces of Holland, these same families of Puritans and their association of bloodlines with military and the church connected. But as far as the stripes with that, it was agreed upon amongst that group of people. But the purpose to have this flag was for one sole purpose, and that was for the identification of ships. And scholars don't acknowledge that these flags were used on the battlefield in the American Revolution, which I find very still today hard to believe. I kind of laugh at that in a way. But and also lighthouses and forts. So they really don't believe that until like the 1830s that these flags weren't used on the battlefield.
Oh, geez, that late, 1830s.
Yeah.
Wow,
yeah.
I thought maybe
yeah.
they
1820s,
were...
1820s, 30s, yeah.
Yeah, I thought maybe they were talking about 1780 or something like that, but 1830s. Whoa, we were a different country.
Yeah, they see it as on forts
mm-hmm.
and lighthouses and on ships and not on the field. And I have a hard time, you know, really believing that. And I had mentioned to you about the Ames flag.
Yeah, we're going to get to that. Oh well, yeah. As a matter of fact, let's get to it now. I mean, my heavens, it's really that important. Go ahead.
It'll circle right back. 5 years ago, I tracked down a flag that was called the Shaw flag. We knew this was an original flag to one of the Navy agents in New London, Connecticut. It was debunked by some other scholars saying you can't prove it real. It's missing that one little percent to prove it authentic. Not one 13 stars and stripes in American history has ever been proven authentic, period, to the American Revolution. And today, I can personally say there is one, and that is the Reverend Nathaniel Ames flag, a flag that I tracked down. And we had to find this, and we did. And it's signed and dated. The flag itself is a document. Nathaniel Ames, who became a reverend, was a simple soldier, but he's a bloodline to John Adams. Moses Payne, who is the Knights Templar founder, we're certain of that. And so Henry Adams, John Adams is his cousin. He was actually with John Adams on the last privateer out of Connecticut that went to Holland, most likely to bring correspondence from Congress and Trumbull to John Adams in Holland. And we can track the ship down that most likely had this flag on it. So he signed it in 1784, just prior to the end of the American Revolution, just weeks before the official end of the Paris Peace Treaty, which is the revised Peace Treaty, which is 1784, after the King signed it prior, King of England.
The field of stars, how are they laid out?
These are called the 4-5-4. And what we know is that the origins has been kind of forgotten, and people didn't recognize. Where does this 4-5-4 that was so well known, and then there's 3-2-3-2-3 pattern,
right,
one on top of each other, which was the Hopkinson design. And I believe the Hopkinson design, who did the Great Seal, he designed the Great Seal, did some work on there, right?
Right, certainly.
Yeah. And basically, I believe that represents the Mid-Atlantic Navy. And then up in New England, the 4-5-4 is origin to the United Confederation family, which is the original Pilgrims of New England.
I see. So that's very interesting. I had not thought in terms of, well, part of our fleet up there in the far north is going to use generally the same flag but a different star pattern.
Exactly.
You know, I didn't expect that.
Letting you know that these are New England ships, and these are Mid-Atlantic. And the U.S. Navy, I believe, they had a 4-5-4 also, but it was upright. So that the center row in the middle, the highest one star in the center top, was a U.S. Navy design. And there's evidence that shows this. But still, no one accepts it as being true.
Well, when you get to 99% possibility of it being what you say it is, what is the last 1% that you need? What is it there to get their acceptance of it?
The 1% is documented evidence, factual written evidence. We had done forensic tests on this flag where it was sent to the same group of people who the founder of that company, I believe, is called McCrone's. They are the people that did he's actually the guy who did the work on the Shroud of Turin for Jesus. Remember the Jesus Shroud?
Oh, yes, yes.
And then back then they had contaminated pieces. They redid it, and then they have new analysis, different group.
Yeah.
But we had found salt water in it, proving the flag was out on the sea with this man. We found 18th century gunpowder smoke in it. The ink was proven to be authentic, period, to the time. Every thread and stitch was origin to the 18th century. So the 1% is that it was signed and dated by him. And when he signed it, he could barely read and write, because we have him documented that after he was on the privateers, he was in the Army, then on the privateer for 2 years, then he was in the merchants after he got released from prison, being captured in Bermuda. He was out at sea for about 5 years in Europe and then the West Indies and then back. And then he went to school for 3 months, and he didn't learn to read and write then until he became a minister. And the one thing that's amazing is that we're also proving that one of his other grandmothers, his great-grandmother, is an AMES, Ames family. He's an EAMES.
Oh.
And what that means is that this grandmother is part of the families who are the founders of Maryland, their line, but to the famous Dr. William Ames, one of the greatest Puritan ministers. Mm-hmm. He was the heads of the armies back in the day of the 1630s. He didn't get to, he was going to be the founding first president of Harvard, but he died in the process. He had got a flu from flooding and died.
Now,
and his children came over, and we believe that one of his sons is the maternal grandfather of this Nathaniel Ames, as well as the Paynes, as well Moses Payne, the Knights Templar descendant, as well as Henry Adams, John Adams' great-grandfather. The Waldos, who are commanders of all these armies also, famous commanders from Massachusetts and Connecticut, and ministers. And some there's a list that goes on, and I don't want to get too far into it, but it's very important.
Well, yes, indeed, it is very important. And of course, the question that looms in the back of my mind that I can't help but want to ask right now is, okay, if this is authentic, what does this mean in regards to the history of our flag and whether or not there was such a flag on our battlefield? Not of course on the ships, which we know there were, but the historians keep saying that there were no flags during the American Revolution on the battlefields, and it seems like that's almost become a religious belief with them. Do you think I'm exaggerating when I say that?
No, the scholars believe that they never existed, but there is evidence from a Rhode Island general, and he had drawn the battlefield plans showing that there were stars and stripes on the in the command post section of the battlefield where the officers were in the back lines, and these are authentic drawings, and this was done by the famous advanced flag scholar Mr. Richardson, who had passed away some years ago, who actually left a couple flags with his family to the town next door to me, which is the Historical Society in Stratford, Connecticut. They have some great flags that show the seven stripes, which goes, again, to show the origins of the seven provinces. That flag was signed and dated and debunked by the greatest institution in the country, some of their scholars associated, and it's really sad. So it's a continuance, and it was signed and dated by a granddaughter of the Revolutionary War soldier. They don't even accept that, these historians, that is authentic enough.
Was
the word of a granddaughter.
Was that the Smithsonian?
The Smithsonian, yeah. They've been involved in historical controversies with flags for many years, but
you're right. They've been involved in many controversies. Things just actually
but they're basing it on evidence, and a lot of that is what they follow. And, you know, it's always a learning curve. So it's not to knock down the Smithsonian anyway.
No.
There are other flags that they've had, but it's still an ongoing learning process.
Mm-hmm.
The study of textiles and what was being used and not used. A lot of people don't believe there were these specific thread twists in cottons that existed that were used, but they were.
Mm-hmm.
There were these homespun materials, and that's what this flag is. This Ames flag is a homespun flag, signed and dated, and it's amazing because we had to do the genealogy work for 5 years to track every single human that was in Ames in existence. I had to become a scholar on seven different families of Ames that aren't from the same bloodlines. And it was actually after that time period and getting to understand it, it became very clear that there's no one that existed that could have signed this flag that was alive at the time.
Now, how did you get involved in all of this?
Where I live in Milford, it's the Milford Colony. As a young boy, this was the sixth oldest town in Connecticut, and I was trying to understand this old seaport. Why is there next to nothing in documents existing in this town, one of the oldest towns in the country? And that was my drive. I was born in a famous sea captain's house, the Coggleshells, descendants who were related to the Arnolds, the first magistrates of Rhode Island, and it was a sea captain family. Three brothers drowned. One was an 1812 privateer George Coggleshell, the only person that was a living captain that was a privateer to document the War of 1812, the privateers.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the thing. It was the drive of being a part of this history, growing up here, and understanding why does nothing exist for documentation in this old town.
Now, before, we just have a couple of minutes left, but sure. I know our listeners are thinking to themselves, how did, in regards to the cannon, do you, or did you, do any diving yourself and to see this cannon, or the one that has the star on it?
I am working on a shipwreck site up in Massachusetts, and we're identifying a cannon that would be directly related to Nathaniel, who has this flag. His great-grandfather was a cannon maker, Waldo, in Scituate, Rhode Island, with the Hopkins family and the Brown family, Brown University. But the cannon that was worked on was by Robert Treat Payne. He was the head of all of the munitions and cannon manufacturing appointed by Continental Congress. And we're certain that it was between him and the Cushings. There were three Cushings. They were cousins. And then there was the Cushing that was the father that was who swore George Washington in. And they believe that the five-pointed star for Massachusetts Bay didn't exist until 1780. But the cannon that was on a fleet of ships, the ships were scuttled at a famous incident called the Penobscot Expedition of 1779. A bunch of divers in the 1950s working on a bridge found these cannons. And then what had happened was they were debunked as, being they were just said to be Paul Revere's. But he wasn't making cannons. So these cannons were made in Bridgewater, Massachusetts, that showed the Indian seal with the five-pointed star in use prior to 1780. So it can't be debunked by the archivists in Massachusetts, who I've talked to often about this.
Yeah, I bet
and
you
so
have.
Basically, go ahead.
I said, I bet you have, and it's one of the reasons why, well, we're out of time tonight, but this is a work in progress, friends, because Gary's going to be rejoining us periodically because we're going to be working on one or two of these projects together. And by the way, I misspoke. It was not, and it was Sharon Hardy is the keeper of the seal what we were with. Priscilla Lynn is the individual that designed the exhibits. And let's just hope that right now they're still at the State Department because I think they could lend us a helping hand in this. We'll be back next week. Actually, Zahara will be with us next week. Thank you very much for joining us, Gary Gianetti.
Talk Radio 680 WCBM, Baltimore, and WCBM.com.
Fox News Radio, I'm Karen Riegel.